their allies, and supporters. Tune in to the Prison Radio Show on the fourth Friday of every month between 11 a.m. and noon, or on the second Thursday of every month between 5 and 6 p.m. To get involved in Prison Radio or finding help searching for past programs, email prison@cqut.ca.
Consider that part of your job, Harvey, to give a man back the dignity he once had. Your only interest is in how he behaves. You'll conform to our ideas of how you should behave.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
You were a number. You weren't a name. You want to be a human. I wasn't Jim Crow, and hell, I was number 586.
Why do you do a warder's job?
It's a good job. Responsible job. Officers like myself trying to...
Scum.
We're only enforcing the law.
Oh, the law. The law. When they hang my husband, is that just...
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show. My name is Noah, and I'm your host for today's show. Today we'll be airing an interview with Jane Dixon Gilmore, one of the authors of the book Will the Circle Be Unbroken, which we gave away during CKUT's annual funding drive. We will be talking with Jane about a law project she's part of that concentrates on writing GLADU reports for Indigenous people facing the criminal justice system. But first, some news items. Marissa Alexander is set to be freed from prison on January 27th. Alexander, an African-American mother of three and domestic violence survivor currently incarcerated in Florida, spent 3 years in jail and a year on house arrest while fighting a life sentence in a self-defense case. Her case was popularized in the last few years by committed organizers from the Free Marissa Now mobilization campaign. She's set to be released on Tuesday, although she will face another 2 years of house arrest. For more information about her case, you can visit freemarissanow.tumblr.com. In more news from south of the border, California has recently passed a law requiring that condoms be made available to all state prisoners. Though sex between prisoners is still unlawful in California, city, county, and state prisons are required to make condoms accessible to people who are incarcerated. We'll start today's show with the interview with Jane Dixon Gilmore. Jane is a professor at Carleton University in Ottawa and also works for the Aboriginal-led law firm Indigenious, which focuses on writing GLADU reports for Indigenous people fighting the criminal justice system.
Well, my name is Jane Dixon Gilmore, and I am an associate professor in law and legal studies at Carleton University. And I've actually published quite a number of items related to my research area, but I believe the one we're here to discuss is the book that I wrote with Carol LaPrairie, entitled Will the Circle Be Unbroken? Aboriginal Communities, Restorative Justice, and the Challenges of Conflict and Change.
Definitely. The Prison Radio Show gave away a copy of that book during this year's annual funding drive for the radio station that we're located at. Do you want to talk a bit about what led you to write the book?
Absolutely, sure. Well, Carol and I had crossed paths a number of times over the years, and Carol was, of course, really one of the leading researchers and quite a prolific writer on a number of issues pertinent to Canadian Indigenous peoples and the criminal justice system. And I, when I met Carol for the first time, was actually an undergraduate at Simon Fraser University in the School of Criminology. But as I said, we continued to cross paths, and I finished my BA and my master's degree at Simon Fraser, went over to the London School of Economics and Political Science in England, and completed my PhD. I then found myself fortunate to receive a position at Carleton University, and I was given the opportunity to work with the James Bay Cree, primarily with the community of Ojibwegamu, on the development of alternative justice processes. And by virtue of that work, Carol and I ended up journeying separately, but arriving at a justice conference that the Crees held in a community, one of the farthest northern Cree communities. We sat through sort of 3 days of discussions and deliberations with the 9 James Bay Cree communities about community justice issues and how to reduce the overrepresentation of Cree people in the court system and in the jails. And Carol and I found ourselves one evening standing in the hallway of the local accommodations, talking about some of the issues that arose in the context of the conference. And we found that we shared a lot of the same views. Among those views primarily was a concern that Aboriginal communities were experiencing an incredible pressure, mostly from influential elites and outsiders to those communities, to embrace restorative justice as a mechanism for dealing with crime and conflict in their midst. And while we applauded the support the communities were receiving to adopt alternative approaches to justice and to try and build traditional approaches into community-based justice mechanisms, we felt very strongly that there was a great deal in the outside pressure to take on restorative justice that reflected a profound lack of understanding of the challenges that many of these communities face, of the nature of a lot of the crime and conflict that they must deal with, and the assumption that restorative justice processes were appropriate and workable within Aboriginal cultures generally. So I think much to the annoyance of other people who were staying in the lodge with us, we ended up standing in the hallway of this lodge for probably three and a half hours, from about 10 o'clock at night till after midnight, talking about this. And at the end of it, we agreed that somebody needed to write a book, that it might end up being a kind of controversial and unpopular book because we were ready to really say what we thought. And that led to us sitting down and writing Will the Circle Be Unbroken? So that is the story. It really came out of our very grounded work in Cree communities in particular, looking at justice issues. Painting with a relatively broad brush, what we see is that restorative justice in Canada really came about through the work of religious and spiritual groups who understood that the criminal justice system really doesn't work very well for anybody, a fact which I think remains true. There was an interest in creating a context where people who had been caught up in crime and conflict could sit down, express their experience of the culture, or pardon me, of the conflict, usually with the assistance of a trained facilitator, someone who can help them to talk about difficult things, and to essentially give victims an opportunity to tell their stories, and to express the harm that was caused to them and articulate what they needed to move forward to return to as the greatest degree possible to their pre-conflict or pre-victimization life, and to give an opportunity to those who had harmed them, to the offenders, to explain themselves, to express their accountability, to make apology, and from that interaction, for victim and offender to come to some manner of compromise position about, you know, how do we resolve the issues between us? How does the offender compensate for the harm? And how do we move forward? So that was really what restorative justice is, and that was very much the basis of how this came into effect in Canada. With regards to changes in the system, a lot of these changes came about through the work of policing organizations, especially policing bodies out in British Columbia, who imported alternative approaches coming out of places like New Zealand and started using them with young offenders. And for Aboriginal people, restorative justice really came to the fore following changes to the criminal code affecting sentencing provisions, which inserted a section which is now quite well known as Section 718.2E, that required judges, when they are sentencing Aboriginal people, to consider both alternative ways of coming to the sentence and any alternatives to incarceration which are reasonable given the circumstances and the offense. So in many respects, restorative justice did not come to the fore immediately as an Aboriginal justice initiative. It became so when, again, predominantly influential elites and outsiders to the Indigenous community in Canada seized upon restorative justice, saw it as a good fit in Aboriginal communities, and began to equate traditional modes of dispute resolution within historic Aboriginal communities as very similar to restorative justice, which, frankly, there are similarities. There are also profound differences. So the fit wasn't an automatic or easy one. But nonetheless, that has brought us to a point where Aboriginal people are still to this day being encouraged to adopt what are essentially restorative justice measures informed by local cultures around conflict resolution and traditional justice methods to deal with crime and conflict in communities in an effort to keep Aboriginal people out of the system to the greatest degree possible.
Okay, and the conference that you and Carol would have met at would have been one of these types of places where restorative justice was being mapped onto traditional conflict resolution practices in Cree communities?
Yes, essentially what we were doing was all the nine communities were getting together and sitting down and talking about what could be done about high rates of crime and conflict in their communities and what could be done that would allow the Crees to respond to these issues without going to the dominant justice system, which, frankly, again, has never been a good place for anybody, but is especially not a good place for Aboriginal people. I really think that some of the most interesting and exciting work that Carol and I did was looking at justice in the James Bay Cree communities. And a lot of my work recently has been in the communities of East Main and Ojibwegamu. And in that context, I have worked with community justice committees, which have been set up in all of the nine James Bay Cree communities, and we have essentially implemented a range of community support mechanisms for dealing with conflicts and problems before they come to the attention of the police and the courts. And we've also put into place a number of programs and supports to work with the itinerant court system, the circuit court system, to, in as many cases as possible, allow the community to deal with people who are facing charges before the courts or who have pled guilty and who could receive a community-based sentence. So we have implemented sentencing circles in some of these communities. We have, in East Maine and Ouchibougamau, there's been extensive training on GLADU and GLADU rights, and community members have been trained to interview and research and write these reports and present them to the courts. We have trained people in the community to assist with healing and talking circles, which are wonderful resources, both, again, for people who are having conflict in their family or with other people in the community, and it's not at the state where it's come to the attention of the police, or in many cases, and more importantly, they don't want it to get to the point where it'll come to the attention of the police. So they want to deal with it in a culturally appropriate and informal way. So these processes are up and running. There's pretty good success with them. Part of the challenges that we faced in communities, and this was something that Carol and I talked about a lot, and we talk about it in the book, is that a lot of communities, not just James Bay Cree communities, but Aboriginal communities across Canada, really suffer with very high degrees of lateral violence and family violence in particular. And there's a lot of good reason to think very long and very hard about dealing, whether one should deal with family violence through these kinds of circle processes. So that's a challenge that we're working through now, especially in James Bay, where there are discussions now about how do communities start to deal with problems within families, partner violence, violence against children. These are really, really tough problems. The criminal courts don't deal with them very well at all, and they present some really compelling challenges to community-based processes as well.
So I want to back up a little bit. I'm curious what drew you to Aboriginal justice as a field in the first place in your life.
Oh, well, actually, I had some extremely good teachers at Simon Fraser who helped us to understand some of these issues better. And then when I was in the last part of my undergraduate, I went up north and lived in Whitehorse in the Yukon, and worked as a clerk for Barry Stewart, who was the judge who was largely behind sentencing circles. And I worked with Barry before he seized on the notion of sentencing circles, and worked with the Kwajalein Dun community to make sentencing circles real. But Barry even then was active in community justice, and he and I were very much working hand in glove, and in terms of trying to help something to happen in the community, especially with youth offenders at that time. And one of the things that struck me about the court system when I was working up there was that, certainly Aboriginal people are the majority in the North, but their representation on the dockets in the courts every time the court sat was so much higher than it should have been in terms of their numbers in the communities. It was clear that the people that we were seeing before the court were often the same people over and over again, that much of what brought them before the court could be very easily understood as historic trauma responses, which are things like very low self-esteem, depression, issues with substance abuse. There were far too many Aboriginal people in the system that nothing that any of us were doing to help the folks that were before the court actually seemed to make any difference, and that really it wasn't surprising that they wouldn't make any difference, because courts are not designed to deal with the kind of broader social and economic and political problems that often result in people being in front of a judge. So when I came back down south from Whitehorse, I was really seized with this, and I felt there had to be a better way. I began doing a lot of research and talking to people. I ended up doing a master's degree on the establishment of separate court structures, then did a PhD and lived in Ganawaga in the Mohawk Territory, and we worked towards separate justice systems there. And now I continue to do that work in many respects, and most recently am working very directly within an Aboriginal-led company that provides Gladue services to the criminal courts.
I was wondering if you could just first do a bit of a history of Gladue for us and
sure.
a bit about how it works.
Well, Gladue essentially came out and is connected with those changes to the sentencing laws in Section 718.2e of the Criminal Code, which required a different, that judges considered not only different ways of coming to sentence, but also different ways of sentencing Aboriginal people. Okay, and what that is there a better way in a given case than putting someone in jail? All right, and there was a Supreme Court decision that came down in the 1990s called the Gladue case, and what Gladue essentially did was it required judges when sentencing an Aboriginal person to take notice and to be informed of the unique background and circumstances that inform the Aboriginal person's life that may help the judge to understand how they came to be standing before them in the courtroom, and also to consider, as I said earlier, any alternatives to incarceration which may be reasonable under the circumstances. And this led to the creation of what have been called the Gladue rights, okay, which is that when an Aboriginal person is facing a possible loss of liberty, a judge does not have discretion not to consider their unique background and circumstances and alternatives to incarceration, and that a more recent Supreme Court decision has said, the IPLE decision has said, that the best way to respect those rights is through the provision of a Gladue report to the court. Right? So a Gladue report essentially tells the Aboriginal person's story to the court. It is the opportunity for an Aboriginal person to be heard in a way that I don't think most Aboriginal people have ever been heard before when they come to court. When my colleagues and I write these reports, we view them very much as part of the healing process for the Aboriginal person. So it tells their story. It is neutral. It tells the good and the bad. But it also tells it in a way that is respectful of everyone involved, both the Aboriginal defendant and the courts. And it also provides alternatives. Right? So at the end of the report, when the judge has heard the story and has a better understanding of this individual's life path, we then offer sentencing alternatives that we feel can address what are, in many cases, the very compelling historic trauma responses and intergenerational effects and experiences that have radically limited the life chances and human potential of many of the people that we see before the courts. So the report itself initiates a healing process by allowing the Aboriginal person in a safe and culturally appropriate context to speak to their history and tell their story. But then we also offer healing interventions that we hope and we believe will be more effective than simply putting someone in jail. Putting someone in jail doesn't fix anything. We have to do more. And that's very much what Gladue reports are about.
I'm wondering, how would Gladue apply to people who are already sentenced and are already serving time, potentially a life sentence?
Well, a life sentence is a somewhat different situation, but Gladue rights apply whenever an Aboriginal person is facing potential loss of liberty. So if you're up for parole and you are an Aboriginal person, the Supreme Court has been very clear that you have these Gladue rights, and if you are facing a parole hearing and you are going, if you fail at that hearing, you face a loss of liberty. You're going back to jail. if you are granted parole and you go out into the world, you can still face a potential loss of liberty if you have difficulties with the parole once you're out. So you should have a Gladue report at the point of the parole hearing, and that is the right of the client. Now, one of the things that we have found, and this has been consistent, and there is some research out there to indicate very clearly that not all courts and not all lawyers are equally well-versed or, how shall we say this diplomatically, not quite as good at ensuring that Gladue rights are respected in the way they should be. So what Aboriginal people, this applies to Métis people, it applies to people with Aboriginal heritage, it applies to Aboriginal people whether or not they have status, it applies to Inuit people, it applies to Indigenous people generally. It is your right. You carry it with you as an Indigenous person, and you, as the carrier of the right, are in the position to say to your lawyer, I am Aboriginal, I want a Gladue report. When you say that, the report must be provided. There must be attention to those Gladue rights. And it is possible to get a Gladue report. It is not as difficult as many people like to think. And if you tell your lawyer quite simply can certainly contact us at Indigenous and Associates. We will provide the report. There are many options. So this is one of those things. In order for a right to be real, we have to speak to our rights. So this is what Aboriginal people who are facing trial or who are in jail and facing a parole hearing or a dangerous offender hearing or a long-term offender hearing, stand up and tell your lawyer, I want my Gladue rights respected.
I was wondering if you could talk a bit about the Indigenous Project.
Yeah, I mean, we're a pretty new bunch. It's an Aboriginal-led company, and it's interesting because there are three of us who are the main partners. Mark Marcellet Nawagabo is really our leader, and Stephen Berry and myself. We had crossed paths a number of times, Mark and I especially, over the past few years, and we would often end up having these conversations because Mark was very deeply involved with community justice processes here in Ottawa through the Odawa Friendship Center. I had been working in communities for longer than I care to admit because it dates me, but basically over 25 years. And Steve as well had been working for a number of First Nations communities for many, many years. And the conversation was always the same. The conversation was always about how the rights of Aboriginal people simply don't seem to get respected. And often, even when they do get respected, they don't get respected in the manner which they should and to the fullest degree possible. And in the past couple of years, often the conversation ended up focusing on Gladue. Because certainly for Mark and I, working directly in the courts and working with Aboriginal people caught up in the criminal justice system, we continually face this frustration that a lot of actors in the legal process, a lot of lawyers and crowns and judges didn't seem to be receiving the kind of support and education they needed to understand what the Gladue right was, why it mattered, and why there should be a Gladue report, and that Aboriginal defendants were often getting limited respect of these rights. They often weren't getting reports. And really disturbingly and really damagingly, both Mark and I had experiences where Aboriginal people that we knew who were in court had faced situations where a judge had said things to them, like in one case, you're not really Indian enough that these rights apply. So really, you know what, we can't help you with a Gladue. You really don't qualify. We had a situation with an offender who was very, very capable of expressing clearly that he wanted his rights respected. And because he had been adopted out as a young child, and was raised by a non-Aboriginal family, the judge said, well, you're not really, in this case, Inuit. You're not really Inuit. So those Gladue rights don't apply. Well, that's absolutely not the case. And in the case of the Inuit person who expressed this to me, he said the hardest part of all of this process has been that that judge sat up there, looked down at me, and said, you're not really Inuit. He erased me. And this kind of, these kinds of stories that we were hearing over and over again, and the things that we were witnessing in the courts, just really made us very unhappy. So, you know, we just decided, okay, if Gladue reports are not being provided to the people that we're working with here in Ottawa, let's do it. Let's start providing these reports. So we did. Back in May and June, we just started, when we came across a client, or we were, Mark often was crossing paths with lawyers who had Aboriginal clients. If they had an Aboriginal client, we wrote a Gladue report, and we provided them to the court. Initially, we were not aware because it doesn't seem to be very well known out there, but legal aid funds Gladue reports. And one of the lawyers for whom we provided a report, and we provided a number of them, and we're not compensated in any way for doing that, save for what was important to us at that time, which was really making sure that the individual's rights were respected. But one of the lawyers said, look, you should be getting compensated for this. Other people in other contexts get compensated for providing these reports. Why are you not getting compensated? So this lawyer, to whom we are quite grateful, went to legal aid and said, I have an Aboriginal client. My Aboriginal client has asked for a Gladue report. They have asked for this company, Indigenous, to provide the report. Will you pay for it? And legal aid said, yes, absolutely. And they paid for it. So now we are, what, 8 or 9 months down the road from that, those early days, and we have provided a large number of reports. We have a large number of active reports, and legal aid pays for them. We simply send an estimate for the work to be done to the lawyer. The lawyer sends it to legal aid, and when the report is done, legal aid pays it. So it's a simple process, and it's meant that a lot more Aboriginal people in Ottawa in particular, and we're now branching out into other areas like Sudbury and Parry Sound and into Quebec, are seeing their Gladue rights realized. And we're getting some incredibly positive feedback from the courts and from legal counsel, and most importantly from our clients. So it's been a hugely rewarding journey, and we are humbled by the approach and the warmth that we have received from many people who have an interest in ensuring that Aboriginal justice is actually a real and genuine part of our existing justice processes.
I have a couple of listener-submitted questions, one of which you're totally allowed to answer in a biased way.
Okay.
The first question is, who's the top legal team that's dealing with Gladue rights in Canada?
Well, we are, actually. I am answering that in a biased way. This is a company that, it's one of, I think, the only companies in Canada that is Aboriginal-led. We produce incredibly high-quality reports. In fact, one of the judges who received one of our early reports said it was simply the best she'd ever seen, and that it had all the information in it that a judge requires, and that it had made a difference. This is probably, I don't know, this comment touched me from a different judge who was quoted in a newspaper remarking on one of our reports that the story of the offender had actually brought tears to her eyes, that she had never been aware that people had these kind of backgrounds, and this is what the Gladue report achieved. We do extensive interviews with the Aboriginal defendant and with people who know them best. We bring in incredibly high-quality peer-reviewed research to make sure that judges understand what historic trauma is, what historic trauma response is, what intergenerational effects are, what are the implications of the first 5 years of life for life chances of people who become caught up with the law. We offer quite extensive cultural and ethnographic background. We view our reports, again, as the opportunity to share the individual story with the court in a way that honors and respects that story and the individual. And we also view it as an opportunity to teach non-Aboriginal people about what it is to be Aboriginal in this country, and to ensure that never again will we have to face a judge saying, well, this person doesn't live on a reserve, so they're not really an Indian. There is a lot of educating to be done, and we are doing it, and I think we're doing it better than anybody else.
The second question was, what legal teams have used GLADU as a challenge in the courts in Canada?
Well, many. Usually it's individual lawyers primarily, but they're... gosh, I wouldn't even know where to begin. There's so many lawyers. Certainly the lawyers that we know here in Ottawa, the criminal bar in general use them here. They are active in any good criminal lawyer who has Aboriginal clients will invoke GLADU and will bring it forward. So I think what's important here is not only that criminal lawyers generally are coming to see that they must have these reports, but also what we are finding is that they face some pretty significant struggles in actually getting the reports out there. Pretty much any lawyer, criminal lawyer, who has Aboriginal clients should have, and many have had, GLADU reports.
My last question is about the Correctional Services Canada, and we touched on this a little bit earlier, but not that in depth. It's around, is the Correctional Services obliged to follow GLADU and respect GLADU rights? You mentioned that they're allowed to be used during parole hearings, but I'm wondering if you know, are there penal lawyers who practice using GLADU rights within the Correctional Services?
Well, interestingly, where we have heard about challenges for Aboriginal people in the system who are facing parole and who want a GLADU report are from organizations like Elizabeth Fry. They are the ones who are bringing this to our attention. And, in fact, we are involved in a case now where a woman is facing a parole hearing and she's being refused a GLADU. I don't think it's a big leap from the positions articulated by the Supreme Court, again, most recently in the Ipili case, to say that if you're up for parole or if you're facing an internal disciplinary hearing which is likely to extend your loss of liberty, then I'm pretty sure a strong case can be made for GLADU, right? And I would push for that hard. Now, the challenge you face is who will pay for that GLADU report. If the individual has a lawyer and has a legal aid lawyer, legal aid will pay for it. Should Correctional Services Canada pay for them? Well, that's a good question. I know that there are some criminal lawyers here in Ottawa who have provided GLADU reports for people facing parole hearings. But, I think that... There is a need for those reports, and again, that the Aboriginal person who is facing the parole hearing needs to express to their Elizabeth Fry or their John Howard worker or their NILO officer, their Native Liaison officer, in the institution that they want their GLADU rights respected. And then if their rep contacts us, we will do everything we can for them to get them that report and get it to them in a timely fashion. We can usually put a report together and have it in legal counsel's hands in 3 weeks. So that's making us pretty popular with lawyers here. So I suspect it would make us fairly popular in prisons as well, because time moves pretty slow there, and waiting 2 months or 3 months, which is common in places like Toronto, for a GLADU report really isn't acceptable.
For folks inside who want to learn more about Indigenous and the type of work that you guys do, is there a phone number that they could call? I know most people inside don't have access to the internet, so
No, they don't. We have a toll-free number, which is 1-866-406-5865. We also have put together a brochure which outlines your Gladue rights, when they apply, how you can actually get a Gladue report, and how to contact us. And those brochures are going to be distributed throughout institutions, initially in Ontario, but we'll also send some to Quebec.
That was Jane Dixon Gilmore. Jane is a professor at Carleton University in Ottawa and works for the Aboriginal-led law firm Indigenious. For those of you looking to contact Indigenious for more information about Gladue reports and other services they offer, their toll-free number again is 1-866-406-5865. The time is presently 11:40, and you're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca.
My name is Robert H. King. I'm one of the freed members of the Angola 3. You're listening to the Prison Radio Show at ckut.ca on 90.3 FM.
Next up on the show, we have Elena and Kai to talk about a project they've been working on called Talk to Me. Hi, folks. Welcome to the show, and thanks so much for being here.
Hi.
Thanks for having us.
So can you, we're going to play a segment that you've put together with the work you've done on the project, but can you just give us a bit of an introduction to the project and tell us what it is?
Absolutely. So the mission of Project Talk to Me is to give a voice to Black Canadians who have directly experienced the prison system.
And what you're about to hear is the first stage of an ongoing project. It is the awareness raising, but also for community healing, not just for the Black community, but for everybody, because we're all connected in this system and we have the privilege to not think about it.
Mm-hmm. Shout out to L. Jones and the folks involved in community radio program in Halifax. You are all a great inspiration. We hope this will encourage reflection and discussion. The recording of these stories took place on the traditional territory of the Ganyagahaga. The Ganyagahaga are the keepers of the eastern door of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. The island called Montreal is known as Teotihuacan in the language of the Ganyagahaga, and it has historically been a meeting place for other indigenous nations, including the Algonquin peoples. In many ways, the story you are about to hear is a part of Canada's continued history as a settler colonial nation.
How would you say that a prison has impacted your life?
Modern concentration camps for blacks.
A big block on life.
Like population control. Like.
They have to be strong mentally in order to endure the things that go on in here.
As I was saying, out of sight, out of mind. Yeah, when you're in jail, you feel that the most, though.
The police's tactics is to keep the person in jail.
They control our life, basically, like they're robots or something.
You don't have nothing, you know, no clothes, nothing. Nobody to come visit you, no letters.
What's prison to me? A waste of life.
Black inmates are one of the fastest growing subpopulations in federal corrections. Over the last 10 years, the number of federally incarcerated black inmates has increased by 80%. Black inmates now account for 9.5% of the total prison population, while representing just 2.9% of the general Canadian population.
Night and day you cry, you don't know why, but then there's no reason how, why love the mystery of...
All of the statistics included in this piece come from the 2012-2013 annual report of the Office of the Correctional Investigator, Howard Sapers.
Bell Canada, you have a collect call from...
Hello?
You may press 1 now to accept the charges, press 2 to refuse the charges, or answer the following question with only yes or...
Can you talk about the reality of being a black person in...
Oh, man.
Yeah.
You know, like, I like to say, hey, Quebec, it's not meant for black people.
I can't really speak for Canada, Clive, just being Quebec. I could walk down the street and the police are going to pass by me and they're going to watch me just because I'm black. Their main intention is to find a reason or create a reason to put us in the jail and get us off the streets when I'm just trying to get a regular education like everybody else. Also in Quebec here, it's worse because There's a lot of profiling going on in this city, and it's harder for us to live.
It's supposed to be Montreal, bilingual. Everybody's supposed to know French and English.
An English black man could find himself into more problems than a French black man.
But do you think it's easier for blacks that are francophones?
I wouldn't say it's easier.
Okay.
But I would say they do have that slight advantage over English-speaking black people.
A lot of the police are French loyalists, you know?
Let's say you go to the metro and can I get a ticket? Mm-hmm. Yeah, he really ain't feeling his day, and he's French. He'd be like, quoi? Qu'est-ce que t'as dit? Quoi? Je comprends pas. You know, and you're just like, yo, I just need a bus ticket. And he ends up taking it like you're getting aggressive with him. Bang, he calls Metro Police or even the regular police, and you got a problem after that, you know?
So when they see that I'm black, then you're gonna, sometimes I get cops that tell you, hey, c'est Québec, parlez français. No, this is Montreal, we're multilinguistic. You learn some English from me. Or if not, then you shouldn't have this job if you can't be able to communicate with the majority of the languages, you know? Since I became what I would call myself bilingual, I'm able to get less problems with the police. I learned something that I had no real interest to learn.
What about interaction, like outside of police interactions? What's the experience of being black?
It's harder to find a job. Even if my credentials are better than the white guy's, he'd probably get a job just because he's white. Just because of the image.
Yo, to tell you the truth,
mm-hmm.
being a black person in here, it's like, you're never, it's like, this racism is never going to end. I don't know if it's because of French English. Who cares if it's French English? It'll never be done.
Numerous examples of stereotyping were also reported by black inmates, primarily in terms of being categorized as a gang member, troublemaker, drug dealer, or womanizer.
This call is from a federal prison.
It seems to me that if you're black and you go out with a stripper or dancer, mm-hmm. automatically you're labeled as a pimp. That's a stereotype they have going on. The police's tactics is to keep the person in jail, and while they're in jail, they go and interview their wife or their mistresses or their woman and say a lot of things, negative things about that person to get the person from outside to turn against the guy that's in jail. Mm-hmm. The stereotype they have going on is either you're a drug dealer or you're a pimp. That's the way they view a black man in Montreal. So when a guy is arguing with his girlfriend, it could be a regular domestic violence or a simple voir de fait, and they will escalate it into pimping. Yes, you know, I have sex with different women and so on, but she knows about all that because I don't lie about it. I tell her straight up, yeah, I had sex with her. You know, you could do whatever you want to do in your life. I'm not, you know, like, we're not that serious. It's not serious.
Mm-hmm.
So, at the same time,
yeah.
You have the white guy. He goes out with a stripper.
Uh-huh.
They get into a fight. It don't go no further than domestic violence. Mm-hmm. It doesn't go any further than voir de fait. It stays there.
You know, you come in, I come in, see, right now, the range that I come in,
yeah.
from here right now, I'll come in this range. And now because I came in this range, they'll put me in as a gang member, a blue gang member. But if a white guy comes in this range, they won't put him as a blue gang member.
Mm.
They'll just leave him like that. But why do I got to be a gang member? You know what I mean? Sometimes you come across guards and you don't speak French, and you know, as much as you try hard to speak French, and you arguing or whatever, and they'll just like turn around and tell you, I don't even speak English, and just leave you like that. Then they'll just transfer you around. Like me, I've been all over, you know. So I'm frustrated, I'm angry, that's true, man. I'm a young dude in here, you know.
Yeah.
I haven't seen daylight, you know, they know that, but they don't care.
Yeah.
They don't care, man. They'll tell you, you know, go there or so we'll put you in the hole. And it's like, all right, whatever.
Can you tell us about your story? Who are you?
From high school, London in a whole different way, unexpectedly.
Can you tell us more about that?
I don't know. It just was, school wasn't as interesting as it was before. And I wasn't too much of a responsible child at that point, you know? So, same thing started happening there, just not going to school. I kind of just neglected school completely and running around in the streets,
right,
into trouble in the streets, and, you know, snowball effect. Starts with little trouble, then more trouble, then more trouble, then to the point you end up getting locked up eventually.
I grew up getting a temper, you know, and like I was saying, like when you get an extra workload as a young, I learned to rebel earlier in life, and that gave me like an attitude type mentality. Basically, like my pops was not there, and my mom, she had like this kind of like rule mentality or ruler mentality, like no new man's gonna come up in the house, you know, because she has three kids, and no man's gonna come up in the house and then try to play that role. So she just never had no man around in the house like that. So basically, when it came down to the man of the house business, it was me, even though I was like 6 years old. So, you know, like, do I do that? Because that's what the man of the house is going to do. It wasn't at the point where I had to go get a job and, you know, crazy, like, yo, you got to bring money in, my little boy. But it wasn't at that point, but it was like stuff like, one time we were living in a house where, like, had a mouse problem in the wintertime. And to this day, I'm petrified of mice. You know what I'm saying? Because that's just because I had a bad experience of having to go collect them off the sticky pad.
Mm.
You know? They get caught up in the sticky pad. Sometimes they're still alive and they're still moving. And my mom's really bad, you know? Females really don't like them kind of stuff. So my mom, why should I have to do it? There's a man in the house. And I'm like 6 years old. Okay, I'm like 10 years old now. And like, I have to move that. And that, I didn't like that. And I always had to do it. So right now, to this day, if I see a mouse right now, I might jump on the table. All because of that one. Like, well, but, and that just comes with being a man of the house type thing, you know? That's a trauma that came with being the man of the house and had to do stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like,
well, first and foremost, you know, I think I got a lot of who I am from my grandmother and my family, because, you know, we went through a lot of hardship, but at the end of the day, we still made it through. So I guess that pretty much made me who I am. You know, my father being murdered and me having like anger issues.
Mm-hmm.
Things of that nature coming up in life. I pretty much worked on it, you know, going through many institutions as far as like spa fit and juvenile settings. And then me currently where I am right now, which is a federal prison.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm pretty grown into a decent man now. When my father died,
mm-hmm,
it was like a major impact on my life because he was always there.
Okay.
For us. And then when he was taken away, I didn't know what else to do. You know what I mean? Because my mother, she was distraught when she turned to drugs. And when she turned to drugs, she turned away from us, her children.
Mm.
So I was like, I was stuck basically in a state of sadness.
That's a good way to a lot of people. Always want us to do better for ourselves because they knew how the neighborhood was like in the early 90s when I was growing up. They knew how it was, what was around, the gang violence, the drugs, all these type of things. They didn't want me in that, and they knew it was easy to get in that because that's all we see growing up. So try to stay away from it, but eventually most men here got caught up.
Is it something you could say, from what you know and from what you saw happening to other people, is it a process that starts really young?
Yeah, it starts young.
It starts young.
Because I don't see no one at this day and age starting into crime, you know. Unless you're just stupid and never learned from what you heard back then. You know, you never started young and you're trying to do something now, you're not going to be, you're not going to have that street knowledge. You're going to get locked up faster.
When we're saying young, like, what would you say is, it's around what?
Like around 11, 12.
11 and 12, eh?
To the early 20s.
I guess, you know, like, we still linger, we still hold on to slavery. Mm-hmm. You know, to our background, to our past. You know, so even when somebody's not really looking bad at us, our guard is already up that they might be thinking that way about us.
Half of the black population in federal corrections were incarcerated for Schedule 1 violent offenses and nearly one-fifth for Schedule 2 drug offenses. As a group, black inmates are not more violent than any other identifiable groups. On average, black inmates are no more likely to be serving a sentence for a violent offense than the general inmate population.
You don't have to explain if you don't want to the experience in prison, but could you tell us how it impacted your life?
I just want to say something, you know, like...
Yeah.
Like, you know, sometimes when you come up in here, these places, you can't be the same nice guy that you are normally. You gotta be something else, too.
If you're inside and you're not reading and you're not keeping up on your own with certain things, well, it does slow you down. It does make you less intelligent, you know? And it's unfortunate in provincial jails, there's not a real big educational system going on here, you know? Mm. As in where I am right now, RDP, if you're in the S ranges, there's no school for you, there's no therapy for you, there's no nothing. You just sit there and you wait till you get your time.
But besides that, I just find it's like a big waste of time. It's nasty in there, it's like dirty. Like the vents are all filled with like lint.
And then sometimes you see a couple of young guys coming in here. They end up getting 25 to life on a first degree murder. And the guy's the same age as you. Just makes you just think differently about life and what you want to do. Or if you ever come out, you know?
That was an audio segment from the Talk to Me project. And we have here in studio Elena and Kai, who are members of the project. And I don't know if you guys want to just say anything about that audio or anything else you want to just say about what we just heard.
Yeah, well, actually, there's going to be several steps to the project. So we started by recording several participants, and we hope to have more. We would love to like make a connection if ever people want to reach out to us and also share their stories. They can contact us at the email talktomeproject@hotmail.com. It's spelled talk_me_project@hotmail.com. And yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty much all there is for the moment. All that to say that we will be airing the project on other stations and other programs in the next couple of weeks. So
great, yeah. Thank you so much again.
Yeah,
and the time is presently 11:58, and you're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca. To find out what's coming up on the next Prison Radio Show and or other prison and prisoner-related activities in the region, check out our blog at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com and click on the calendar section. If you'd like us to post an event you are hosting, email us at prison@ckut.ca. You can also subscribe to our podcast. The next Prison Radio Show will air next week. We have another Friday show this month, so don't miss out. We'll be on air on Friday, January 30th at 11 a.m. If you have any questions about anything that you've heard on today's show, or if you wish to be involved with the show, feel free to contact us at prison@ckut.ca. Formerly incarcerated people are encouraged to participate. Folks can also leave a message on our listener comment line at 514-448-4041, extension 2547. If you're in prison, we encourage you to participate in the show in any way possible. Feel free to write us at the Prison Radio Show, or simply write PRS, care of CKUT, 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, postal code H3A2B3. Thanks for tuning into the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name's Noah. I've been your host for today. Please stay tuned.
Thank you.